First edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Thursday. Support for WEAA is support for WEAA traffic and MTA is provided by Sherwin Williams. Coming up in the second hour of the show, it is the infamous, the notorious NWA Sports Report with all the usual suspects. We've got a lot to get to, my goodness. Colin Kaepernick, this is the story that will not go away. Spike Lee, filmmaker, is leading a protest outside of NFL headquarters in New York, or has done it. He also talked to Anderson Cooper, of CNN about the Kaepernick situation. Allegedly, an anonymous NFL executive said, this is not about Kaepernick's performance, this is about what he did, standing up for black people, people of color, disenfranchised people across the country. So we'll get into all that. Khalil Mack of my beloved Oakland Raiders and Derek Carr also. They say they weren't protesting, but they were because Khalil was kneeling and Derek had his hand on his shoulder. They were just saying Derek and Khalil were showing love for each other, support for each other, their best friends. Cleveland Browns praying instead of protesting during the national anthem. Kyrie Irving being traded from the Cavs to the Celtics for Isaiah Thomas, Joe Crowder, and Nets first-round draft pick. All of that's coming up in the infamous, notorious NWA Sports Report in the second hour of the show. A little bit later, in this first hour, we'll be joined by our friend Marvin Doc Cheatham, CEO of the Matthew A. Henson Community Development Corporation, former president of the Baltimore branch of the NAACP, talking about a story that you will only see in the Afro newspaper, the Coast Guard cutter Tawny, Roger B. Tawny, floating in the waters of the Baltimore's Inner Harbor. Right now, as we speak, two statues have been taken down of Tawny, one in Annapolis, one in Baltimore. Yet there's a Coast Guard cutter that bears his name that has been floating in the waters of Baltimore's Inner Harbor for years. We'll talk about that story as well as Baltimore's profound history of civil rights and human rights activism. That's all coming up with Marvin Doc Cheatham. But before we get to Doc Cheatham, we'll go to Cheryl Wood. She's a former federal prosecutor and founder of the Wood Law Firm. We're going to be talking about the aftermath of Charlottesville and the possible hate crime charges against James Alex Fields, the man who plowed his car into those counter-protesters to the neo-Nazis protesting in Charlottesville a couple of weeks ago, killing one woman, Heather Heyer, and injuring 19 other people. We'll also talk about Robert Mueller being protected via legislation in the Senate from Donald Trump firing him as he conducts his Russia investigation. Cheryl Wood, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Before we get to work, let me remind our listeners to make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yeos. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I will share with the people unless you don't want me to. And of course, I will not. Back to Cheryl Wood of the Wood Law Firm. So, Cheryl, what I think a lot of people may have been pleasantly surprised about was in the aftermath of Charlottesville, that horrific tragedy, and the young woman, as I mentioned, dying, 19 other people injured. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, his full name, came out rather aggressively saying, we will do everything in our power to prosecute these individuals who committed these crimes in Charlottesville. And he came out pretty quickly also saying that it seems clear that special hate crime statutes are applicable in the case of James Alex Fields, the man accused of killing Heather Heyer and injuring those other people. Were you surprised to see Sessions' reaction in that context?
Well, I was. And he also said that this may be a case of domestic terrorism, which
right.
was quite different than what the president was saying. So, Jeff Sessions is a longtime prosecutor, both from a state level and a federal level. And so I'm glad to see that he can see that. But I think what ultimately what's happening now and what will happen is that the state of Virginia has brought charges and will continue to bring charges. And if there's a hate crime charge brought, it will be brought by Virginia. So at the same time that AG Sessions is being bold, I don't think he'll actually have to do anything. And I think that Virginia's hate crime statute is a little broader than the federal statute. The federal statute does offer some enhanced sentencing penalties, but the federal statute really, it has to involve someone's protected rights, like or protected class, like your race or your gender or your sexual orientation, and there's a whole list. Whereas Virginia broadens that and says it also protects you, the hate crime statute, the state one, if you are engaged in an activity that is protected by the Constitution, either the U.S. Constitution or the Virginia Constitution, and that would include the right to lawfully assemble. And so the Virginia statute looks like the better way to go. They have brought additional charges against that driver
right.
just today or yesterday, and they haven't yet brought the hate crime, but I think it'll be brought by Virginia.
So you're right. I believe there were five additional felonies brought against the driver of that car in that attack in Charlottesville. Explain for us, though, Cheryl, if you can, why he was not charged with first degree murder as opposed to second degree.
Well, I frankly haven't examined closely the Virginia statute for second degree murder, but because of the reckless nature of it, and if their first degree requires like a premeditation, they might have some trouble proving that.
Okay.
So therefore, it seems more like a reckless act just done on the spur of the moment as opposed to planning it,
because
mm-hmm. you wouldn't have known what the protest would look like necessarily. So I think that's why. I mean, we've seen cases in the past across the country where first degree was brought and it was unsuccessful. And so I think that's why they want to ensure or better ensure a conviction. And so they have a better chance with doing it. And at least it's not reckless, vehicular manslaughter, which is another charge, which I don't even know if they have in Virginia, but it's certainly some places. So I think the second degree might be the right choice given the facts and circumstances.
So, but from your assessment, Virginia probably would have a path that would be more plausible in prosecuting this young man and potentially with the hate crime statute attached to it.
Absolutely. I mean, I recall that having worked in the civil rights division, criminal section of DOJ, where we brought hate crimes, it's difficult. They have some of the evidence they need here with regards. Now we have social media as opposed to back when I prosecuted these cases, and you can often find out an individual's background because you need some other evidence to show why they were doing this, why this is a hate crime. And often that evidence comes from elsewhere, not during the commission of the crime itself. Because unless you have that suspect or that defendant uttering some words at the same time that they are committing the crime, you got to find somewhere else, evidence that shows that they might have committed this for a reason involving some sort of discrimination against someone or that sort of thing. And so here they've got a lot of information about him being very sympathetic to, if not membership in, a white supremacist organization. They have a lot of his writings and different things. So that before we would have to do a search warrant and go in someone's house and try to find books and things, but now with social media, these cases are a bit easier to make because you're able to find evidence of their background that would support the reason why they committed this particular crime.
Right. From my uninformed eyes, I guess, non-expert eyes, the fact that he was marching with neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan members seems clear that he had hate in his heart. But I know the legal parameters are a lot different than Sean Yost's parameters, I guess.
Well, no, and I think that's good evidence as well, without question. And I think they've got even more to support that in his history, in his writings, and his social media.
Very good. There was one white supremacist who was part of that Charlottesville tragedy, Chris Cantwell, who wound up turning himself in to Virginia authorities. He allegedly was seen crying on social media after so much anger was directed at him in the wake of what transpired in Charlottesville. He seemed to just understand that it was better for him to be, because I believe they're charging him with felonies, just to turn himself in, as opposed to being on the run in this capacity.
Yes, I saw where they're charging Chris Cantwell. I'm not sure of all the details of that, but yes, in addition to the driver of the car that killed the young woman and also injured so many others, this Cantwell is being charged as well, and I look forward to providing more detail about that as it becomes available.
Right. He turned himself in on yesterday, as a matter of fact. Right. Let's move over to Robert Mueller, Cheryl. But before we move on, let me remind listeners that if you're just tuning in, you are listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host, editor of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Not in the studio, but on the phone with Cheryl Wood. She's a former federal prosecutor and founder of the Wood Law Firm. On to Robert Mueller. There is a push in the Senate to craft legislation to protect Robert Mueller, quite frankly, the special prosecutor, special counsel Robert Mueller, from being fired by Donald Trump, as Donald Trump fired James Comey, the former FBI director. The fact that the Senate has to go to the lengths of crafting special legislation to protect him from a vengeful and quite frankly frightened Donald Trump is, that seems almost unprecedented. Cheryl, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we can hear you now. Did you hear my question?
I did.
You did or did not?
I did not.
Okay,
sorry.
So that's okay. So I was saying that it's pretty extraordinary that the Senate has to actually craft legislation to protect Robert Mueller from being fired by Donald Trump, as Donald Trump fired James Comey. That scenario seems like it could be unprecedented.
Well, I think that's right. We no longer have the independent counsel statute, and so now with this special counsel Mueller, and with Trump continuously kind of threatening and things being in the press that he's thinking about firing Mueller, there's bipartisan support for this. Support is really about Sessions too, and we have to remember that the Attorney General is a former senator. And there are two senators, bipartisan, the Republicans from North Carolina, Tillis and Coon from Delaware, who's a Democrat, who've gotten together and are proposing this legislation today that would, it doesn't take away the president's right to fire Mueller, but it does add a judicial review of that firing should it occur. And so it adds another layer of scrutiny so that it can't be done just willy-nilly for no reason, or for the reason that, hey, you're investigating me too well, so I'm going to fire you. And so that's what's happening there. And then they added another aspect of it, and this is where Attorney General Sessions comes in, and that is that if an attorney general were to fire Mueller, it has to be an attorney general that was confirmed by the Senate. So in other words, the president couldn't just get rid of Sessions and then have his replacement, who would be an acting attorney general for a while until they confirm one, and have that person fire Mueller. So it's really cutting off, either limiting power or cutting off power. And so that's really, and the second part of that is really about protecting Sessions. And because Sessions is a former senator, he gets a bit of favor with the Senate. And
yes,
it was the same way with Ashcroft when he was attorney general, because he was a former senator. And you don't see that happen. You don't see it happen with Reno. You didn't see it happen with Holder, and certainly not with Lynch. But because they're former senators, the senators try to protect them. And this also demonstrates the erosion of support for Trump. We may not be rising to the level of impeachment, but this shows that there are senators on the Republican side that are willing to step up and say, hey, we got to limit this president's power, because if he fires Mueller, you know, what would the optics of that be?
Well, what would, from your perspective, Cheryl, as a former federal prosecutor who worked with the DOJ, if he fired Mueller, I can't imagine what the aftermath of that would be. It would be pandemonium in some ways, because Mueller has a reputation that is in some ways beyond reproach, especially in the corridors in which we're talking about. The Senate, the DOJ, the FBI. This is someone with a sparkling reputation, and for the president, the 45th president, to act in such a vengeful, directly vengeful way. What could be the reaction if that did actually happen?
Well, I think we've seen a number of things that we have seen the president do that we thought would, you know, really shake things up and really be very bad for him, and they haven't been.
Hmm.
And so, and his base still supports him because of whatever reason he decides to throw out of why he did it. And so that's why the Senate wants to act. They're not taking away his ability to do it, but they're placing it under judicial review should he do so. And it's because I don't think President Trump necessarily is worried about the reaction. He's more operating from a place of, what can I do to protect myself?
And his family.
I'm still going to have these supporters no matter what I do. So I can fire Mueller and still be president and still have my base support. So I don't think he's worried about it. He hasn't done it yet. There's obviously somebody in his ear that is keeping him from doing this. And I think this legislation will certainly help if he decides to do it, that there would be a review of it. And there's certainly no reason that I've seen that Mueller should be fired. So this would effectively cut off, I think, his ability to fire him, because the judge's judicial review would not uphold that.
Well, let me go be a bit more specific, Cheryl. I mean, yeah. I'm not necessarily thinking about the reaction of his supporters. I'm thinking about the reaction of the Senate itself. It would seem like that type of broadside, that type of really aggressive action on the part of the 45th president would incline them or compel them to be more mindful or more willing, if you will, to move forward in the process of impeachment. It seems like that, at least that's in my thinking.
Well, you would certainly hope so. I don't hold out a lot of hope for that. I mean, firing the FBI director should have been enough for that,
wow,
as far as I'm concerned. Comey. So, you know, I understand if there's nothing preventing him from doing it, which right now there isn't, and there's no review of it. Do I think that if he did that they would necessarily impeach him? I'm not sure. I thought a number of things that he's done, you know, we could already be, articles of impeachment could already be filed, and there seems to be a real hesitancy to do so. And so I would hope that would push things along and that would be the thing that would cause. But how many times have we thought, okay, this is going to be the thing, or we thought that he should be under articles of impeachment, and he's not.
Right.
And so I do think it would be a tremendously huge mistake on his part to do so, and that's why he hasn't done it, because he'd have done it already if he felt like he could. Would this push enough Republican senators to file articles of impeachment? Possibly, because there have been other things right now that he's done. And, you know, he's already with Mitch McConnell. They're not speaking. He's going out to Arizona and speaking against both of the senators there,
right,
McCain and Flake. And so he is doing a number of things that might, in addition to if he fired Mueller, might bring them to that point.
Let me take a quick phone call, Cheryl, before we finish up. Let me go to Brother Leo Burrows in Bolton Hill. Brother Burrows, welcome to the show.
Yes, good evening, my friend.
Good evening,
always.
Sir. Yes, sir.
I'm hoping that we call upon Senator Chris Van Hollen, Senator Ben Cardin, Paul Sarbanes, and Elijah Cummings to take a stand that if the retaliatory firings occur in the person of Bob Mueller, that they will in fact initiate impeachment proceedings or attempt to. I think it's a mistake not to utilize or tell them up front that we expect them to take that action, given the high level of cowardice that I see manifest among the congressmen and senators in general. They seem to be scared to death of Donald the actor Trump. And true, he is the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler, but you've got to take a stand. You've got to act like you've got guts, even if you're gutless. So I think we've got to tell our congressmen and senators right now what we expect of them. And if we don't, then the hell to pay. We've got hell to pay with this president who might do anything and commit any atrocity.
Brother Burroughs, thank you for your comments, as always. Sure, we're almost out of time, but ultimately, when you have someone like Bob Corker of Tennessee, one of the more sober conservative, and when I say conservative, not just politically conservative, but just not someone who is subject to exaggeration or hype hyperbole. When you have him say that this president has not exhibited the control for, I'm paraphrasing, the control, the temperament to be president of the United States, that is, in my mind, a very damning statement coming from someone specifically like Bob Corker.
Absolutely. And you do have more and more, slowly, more and more politicians stepping up and going against Trump, and we're seeing more Republicans do that. But I think Brother Burroughs is right. You know, we need across the country to put more pressure on our elected officials to take certain actions, and that's generally not done, and to be proactive and do it before something happens as opposed to being reactive. And they are elected by us, and so we have that ability. How do we do that? Number one, who organizes that? You know, those are the sorts of things that need to be answered. But I think that's a good idea. They do seem scared, but slowly Trump is doing enough to kind of get some of these Republican senators who are in control to actually come out against it.
Yeah, I think the word that Corker used was stability. Cheryl Wood is a former federal prosecutor. She's founder of the Wood Law Firm. Cheryl, we greatly appreciate your insight on these issues, as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Of course. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Doc Cheatham will be here, former Baltimore chapter president of the NAACP, to talk about the USCGC Roger B. Taney floating in the harbor of inner harbor of Baltimore right now as we speak. The statues are gone, but the Roger Taney is still floating in the harbor of the inner harbor. Stay tuned. We'll talk to Doc Cheatham next. First edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host, editor of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, making the transition from former federal prosecutor Cheryl Wood to Marvin Doc Cheatham. He is the CEO of the Matthew A. Henson Community Development Corporation, also the former president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. Doc, always good to see you.
It is an honor to be here, and I want to add a little something. I've also served as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and I also serve as president of the National Action Network, one of our hosts of another show. It says very clear, I'm probably the only craziest person that headed up three national civil rights groups here, and as folks know, didn't get paid a cent.
Well, that just speaks to your commitment to black people, and we are the better for it, quite frankly, Doc. Thank you for your service as always. But this USCGC, Roger B. Taney, this is a story you will only find in the Afro newspaper on the pages of the Baltimore Afro. The headline, USCGC, Roger B. Taney, White Supremacy Floats in Baltimore's Inner Harbor. We removed the statues of Roger Taney were removed in Baltimore last week. Also, statue in Annapolis of Taney was removed from Annapolis from the State House grounds. Yet this boat, this massive Coast Guard cutter, has been floating, you know, quietly on the waters of the Inner Harbor, nestled between the Columbus Center and the power plant for years, for years.
Sean, I worked downtown, almost directly across the street from the Inner Harbor for 41 years. I can't say how many, probably hundreds of times I've seen it. Until you and the Afro, and of course I'm happy to say I'm a subscriber, and folks, if you're not, you need to become a subscriber.
Amen, amen.
But never knew that that was it. You know, I would say very candidly, if we were to take every week between now and the end of this year, I feel quite certain we can find buildings, could be planes, could be boats, could be a whole plethora of things that are named after individuals that should not have received that distinction. And if you look back at the history, our coalition looked at the Lee Jackson statue. It was very clear that the history is that these designations were done by individuals to speak out against what we were doing in the area of civil rights, as well as, prop up those races that they support. I really think this is an opportune time for us, especially with school systems about to reopen, especially in Baltimore City, for us to change the dialogue. I think we need to begin discussing how many buildings had African-American names on them of heroes and heroes that had been taken down. One was my mentor, and of course we had Reginald Lewis's name taken down. But I think at the same time, we need to discuss those schools that have names where the students have not really been told and educated who are these individuals. I would also say this is an opportune time for us to stop naming these buildings with these crazy names that have nothing to do with anything but someone not living in our city coming here and putting names on buildings. I really think this is an opportune time for those of us that are concerned about the history our children are not getting in public schools. Could be Baltimore City, could be Baltimore County. For us to begin educating our individuals. We were asked, who do we want to see replace the Jackson statue? And we said, of course, very immediately that it should be Harriet Tubman. But I've now sent to the Episcopal Archdiocese that they need to consider taking a lead of an individual born here in Baltimore City, who I would say 99% of us living here in Baltimore know very little about this lady. Her name was Pauli Murray. Mm-hmm. She was the first African-American female that became an ordained Episcopal priest. She received her law degree, her church degree, a PhD. She is the one that labeled the term Jane Crow. She is the co-founder of the National Organization of Women. This lady's history goes on and on. 15 years before Rosa Parks, she got arrested. And the reason NAACP didn't take her case was they didn't charge her with basically violating the transportation law. They basically charged her for basically not getting off the bus. But this was 1940, 15 years before Rosa. Mm. This woman's history is remarkable. Mm. Remarkable. I think we need to begin to uplift heroes and heroes. And folks, if you haven't had a chance to check out our heroes and heroes, I put together a booklet maybe almost 10 years ago, and it has that name. name, Sheroes and Heroes Born in Baltimore City. And it uplifts the sheroes and heroes that we have and in one area, second to no city in the entire United States. When you look at civil rights, you look at litigation, legislation, and leaders, those three areas, there is no city in America that can touch us.
Well, that's absolutely true. I'm going to drill down a little bit deeper to that in a few more moments, Doc. But I want to talk a little bit more about Tawny because I think people need to understand from the context in which we've been talking about Roger Tawny, people of the right mind and spirit understand that this was not a good man. We understand that. But I want to read some of the words from what Roger Tawny wrote in the infamous now Dred Scott decision. He literally in this decision affirmed the mantra of white supremacists,
yes,
that
sir.
Black people were subhuman.
Yes, sir.
And those words, it serves as a reminder to people specifically who this person is. And of course, this is my story, and now I can't find the words, and I wrote the story. But but the reality is that the Dred Scott decision has been named by many historians, many legal analysts as the worst Supreme Court decision in the history of the court. Let me read part of Tawny's opinion written in 1857. He says, quote, "They had," meaning black people, "for more than a century before been regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit." This is just part of that opinion that was written by Tawny, who was a native of Maryland, Calvert County, where he was born. And the United States government, in its infinite wisdom, decided to honor this man.
Honor him, yes.
To honor him by naming a Coast Guard cutter after him. It was commissioned in the mid-1930s. It saw duty during peacetime and wartime, specifically during World War II at Pearl Harbor, where allegedly it engaged Japanese airplanes flying overhead over above Honolulu during Pearl Harbor. The attack on Pearl Harbor. It was decommissioned in 1986, I believe, and donated to the city of Baltimore, and has basically been floating around Baltimore waters ever since then. And as we both indicated, right underneath our noses. Yeah. I never knew. I remember seeing that Coast Guard cutter many, many, many times at the Inner Harbor, but never knew it was the Roger B. Tawny.
And elevated. Not only does it have the name, but Baltimore Historic and Maryland Historic, both organizations have them actually in their whole diagram. Mm. You know, the fact that this naming is basically put up on a high pedestal,
right,
like there's something great. And I'm hoping that our Maryland Legislative Black Caucus follows the great lead of Cheryl Glenn. I understand that she is challenging, along with others, some statements or absence of statements coming from our senator, Mike Miller, were basically almost doing what the president said, you know, almost uplifting them, congratulating them that they did something. And I'm saying, you know, I really think we could probably spend the entire rest of the year looking back at streets and roads and highways and buildings and planes and boats with names of individuals who were uplifted. Usually you'll see coinciding with the increase in the civil rights fight.
Right. It just speaks to the power in which the civil rights fighters of those times operated because of what they were facing. Because they were literally operating in the very face of white supremacist racism overtly practiced. Brandon Scott, I spoke to him quickly.
I like that
the other day, and got his response to this tawny ship floating in the Inner Harbor. And one of the things that he said is, of course, we should rename it. But he thought maybe the name should be changed to Frederick Douglass, which
is right there in the exact same neighborhood.
I mean, we know that Frederick Douglass is a young boy, as a young slave, was in the Fells Point neighbor community for a few years. And so it would fit perfectly, quite frankly, this Maryland native, one of the great Americans in the history of this country. I think it would be great. But I want to announce now, I would say unofficially, I want to start a contest. I want to have a contest to rename the Tawny.
Okay.
send your suggestions to the Afro newspaper if you want to write. If people still actually write letters, you can send your suggestions to the Afro newspaper or send them to me directly by email. SYOS@afro.com. SYOS@afro.com. What should we rename the Roger B. Tawny? Because I believe, given this city council that we have in place right now, especially these eight newest members, it's only going to be a matter of time before we actually rename the Roger B. Tawny. It's interesting that this ship is actually facilitated or overseen by the Living Classrooms Organization Foundation.
Well, I'm not surprised. I'm not one of the strong enthusiasts of Living Classrooms. Just like there's some other groups we have here that I'm not too happy with as well. We got folks that don't look like our community that are in our community basically receiving funds and benefiting from things that I think are African-American, since we are the predominance in the city, that our organization should be getting the funding that they have. But I was shocked. I really want to commend you and the Afro for bringing this to our attention, because, as I said, we probably have hundreds of these namings, and you'll see they will kind of coincide, overlap with the civil rights fight. I think there's far, far much more that we need to do in better educating. I think we need to turn the script and say, let's take this opportunity to do a better job to educate our children of the greatness of the individuals that have come through Baltimore City and through the state of Maryland. I just think that we have not done a good job, and some of that is our fault, Sean. We can lay blame on the Baltimore City public school system, but when in fact we have to take some onus and some responsibility to educate our children. And right now, I'm very displeased with what little our children are getting. You know, I love Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, but every February, we don't need to keep hearing about them every time. There are hundreds of folks right here in Baltimore that have done some miraculous things.
We could, honestly, Doc, we could spend all of Black History Month just talking about Black civil rights leaders.
Yes.
I mean, in depth. And with great substance.
Without a doubt. And now is an appropriate time for us to make this a part of the discussion, starting with the Baltimore City public school system. You know, let's learn something. Let's let our children learn something. Let's let our parents. I go to a lot of schools speaking to kids. And most schools that I go to, of course, many of the schools still have names of heroes and heroes of African-American descent. And I ask the children, do they know who that individual is? And much to my dismay,
yeah,
they don't know. They don't know. You know, it's like Robert Coleman. Folks don't know who Robert Coleman is. Well, if you live anywhere back in the 50s and 40s and you came to Baltimore or Richmond, you needed to know what businesses were in the area. Well, this guy actually wrote what was called the Blue Book. You could look in the book and find out who lived where, what businesses were there. And many folks don't know, you know, that this guy probably is the founder of the organization Dealing for Blind here in the state of Maryland. Mm-hmm. But here, a name that people don't know. There's just so much that we can benefit by educating our folks. And I'm saying, let's turn the script. Let's turn the script on this stuff about white supremacy. Let's educate our community, more especially our children, of the great contributions that have been made.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. I'm in the studio with Marvin Doc Cheatham. He is the CEO of the Matthew A. Henson Community Development Corporation, also former president of the Baltimore branch of the NAACP, Baltimore branch of the SCLC, Baltimore branch of the NA National Action Network, NAN, I was going to say. And we're talking about the great history, the rich civil rights history of our city. In the wake of this, not discovery, but us putting it on the front page of the Baltimore section of the Afro, the Roger B. Tawny floating, white supremacy floating in Baltimore's Inner Harbor. Let's take a quick phone call. Let's go to Oscar in Northwest Baltimore. Oscar, you're on with Doc Cheatham. How you doing, Oscar?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Well, first of all, you know, well, kudos to you, Sean, and the Afro for bringing it up, but I've been knowing about Tawny for a long time. But let's be careful. I hear some Negroes in the city on talk radio, jumping up and down, saying, let's go after Mike Miller, because he didn't want to take Connie's statue down. Well, it's down now, so that's passe. But if we want to go to that, if we want to hold Miller feet to the fire, let's hold Hogan's feet to the fire. Because originally, he wasn't for taking it down. And in West Virginia, they had a Democratic governor, and he changed his affiliation and went to became a Republican. So if we are so interested in holding people's feet to the fire, let's hold Hogan's feet to the fire and say, since you belong to a party with the likes of Donald Trump and you are so for black people, change your affiliation, Hogan. Let's do that. See how many Negroes would do that. Let's call on Hogan to change his affiliation because he's in the party. I don't want to hear that nonsense about what's different from the Republican Party on the state level and the federal. They're the same people, the exact same people on the state, city, local level. And I hear the name. Let's petition to have Nat Turner's name put replace some of these statues.
Okay.
Y'all for that?
I like that.
Okay.
I like that a lot.
All right.
Oscar, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Ernest next. Ernest, you're on First Edition with Doc Cheatham. How you doing, Ernest?
Yeah, good evening to you and your guests.
Yes, sir.
Good evening.
What Judge Roger Bitani said, that black people has no right that white people are bound to respect.
Right.
And that's what it is today. I mean, did Shamir Rice, did they respect taking his life?
No.
Or any other black person's life that they took, Freddie Gray, they know when he was in police custody, that he died in police custody. Did anybody talk up and say that these police should be found guilty?
Well, yeah.
No, you ain't heard no white person.
Oh, no.
Except for Professor Colbert.
Right.
Everybody was given a reason why they should get off, so... What he's saying is actually what's going on today.
Absolutely true. I think it's true.
So even though you removed the statue of Robert Taney, Judge Taney or whatever, it's still in the mind of racists and white supremacists in this government. The president of the United States feels the same exact way as Roger Taney feels.
Oh, he does. It's true. Ernest, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Doc, let's dig down into some of Baltimore's history while we have some time left in the segment. I always, when I think about Baltimore history, I always dig out my copy of the Afro Chronicles.
Okay.
The Road to Brown. And in my mind, and I know that, I mean, when you have a city that has the largest free black population in the United States 10 years prior to the Civil War, there's something good that's going to come out of those people that fought for in whatever way they did to free themselves or to be freed. And what we saw that in the next generation was a cadre of lawyers that came up that began the work of civil rights in Baltimore and in the United States in the early 1900s. When you talk about W. Ashby Hawkins and McMeekin and these other brave men. And then we come forward to the 1930s and we see Thurgood Marshall comes forward and the work that he did with Charles Hamlin in Houston in laying the groundwork for the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. We see the work of Juanita Jackson Mitchell, the Mitchell families, the Murphys, and so many other people. This city was literally the vanguard city. We took a backseat to no city. We didn't take a backseat to New York, Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, or any other city. This was the vanguard city for civil rights and human rights activism in the United States.
Just about every area where there was some form of discrimination or racism, whether it was recreation, whether it was education, whether it was employment, whether it was housing, every area, you will see that either the litigation or legislation started here. Brown versus Board of Education started here out of Baltimore City and Baltimore County. You know, I claim the fame one thing. Our aunt, Louise Kerr Hines.
Indeed.
She was the one who filed a lawsuit represented by Thurgood Marshall
and
Charles Hamilton
and her dad.
Her dad, who was the Dr. Kerr's cough medicine.
Yes.
She filed a lawsuit against Ena Pratt Library. We say even today, Dr. Hayden, outstanding now. She's in Washington, D.C., and she had our aunt's picture and bio in the library that she filed a lawsuit against the library. Wasn't specifically saying that the library was discriminating, but the customers, the residents who were going to the library refused to have African-Americans in supervisory positions at Ina Pratt Library. She sued. The first time they lost, it went to the Supreme Court. It came back a second time, and she actually won the case, which was an employment type of discrimination. You can't secondarily receive federal and state money and then discriminate. And Ina Pratt was found guilty. Oh, my goodness gracious. That is my dear, sweet aunt. May God rest her soul.
I spoke to her. I spoke to her right before she died. I interviewed her right
my
before
goodness,
she
yeah.
died.
Louise Kerr, believe me, just about every case you can think of, you know, going to a beach, you name it, it started here. You know, and, you know, unfortunately, I would say some of our folks that have passed on are probably turning over in their graves if they were to even imagine what we have done with this city, how we have gone in the wrong direction. And I think to some degree, we have to look, and I think two of your previous callers, we got to look at folks that look like you and I and indicate, how did y'all allow us to go in the wrong direction? We need to wake up. We need to better educate our children and our adults to turn this thing around. And I think every opportunity talking about white supremacy is an excellent opportunity to start talking about education, what we need to do to better educate our children. Understand it wasn't always where you could go to any store, that you could try on clothes, that you go eat anywhere, that you could ride on the highway and could go to a bathroom, that we used to have to ride and pull over to the road to go to the bathroom. I mean, we have come so far, and now we're going in the wrong direction.
You mentioned recreation. I know that the reporting that I did back in 2004 with Larry Gibson, the University of Maryland law professor Larry Gibson, indicates Little Willie Adams was behind the desegregation of the golf courses
yes.
in the city of Baltimore. Him and Dallas Nicholas, the attorney. Here's another photo.
My goodness.
Yeah, man. It took, I believe, 13 years to desegregate the golf courses. But Willie Adams stuck with it. And part of the impetus was that Joe Lewis, who was great friends with Willie Adams, came to Baltimore and was not allowed to play on a full golf course. He had to go to what was the black golf course? Was Clifton Park? Not what Clifton Park. Lake Clifton Park was the one that they aspired to, but it was one that only had 9 holes.
The black golf course
had 9 holes.
And
the fact that Joe Lewis, the former heavyweight champion of the world, had to suffer the indignity of playing a 9-hole golf course because he was black and coming to visit his friend Willie Adams in Baltimore, that's what started Willie Adams wanting to change the law and open it up.
And that almost leads us to the issue that Spike Lee is addressing, which I think needs to be a part of our major dialogue.
You know, we're talking about it in the second hour, the NWA Sports. You want to hang out for the NWA, Doc? You can if you want to.
I would love to, because I would say very clearly that here it is, an individual stood up to speak on behalf of an issue that we all basically on the same page with, you know, police killing African-Americans unjustifiably. He stands up and now he's being punished. And we're saying, oh, because we love the NFL and our home team so well that we are afraid to say, no, we're going to turn it off. No, we're not going to go to your game. No, we're going to say in some way, shape, or form, this brother was standing up for all of us. And why are we afraid to join him and say, we got to say enough is enough? We don't care how many billions of dollars the NFL is making off of our African-American brothers. At some point, we have to say, this brother stood up and we're going to stand up with him.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. Let's go to Professor University of Maryland Law Professor Doug Colbert real quick. Doug, you're on First Edition with Doc Cheatham. How you doing, Doug?
Doc Cheatham, I couldn't agree with you guys more in terms of what you want to do to connect the present to the past. Mr. Kaepernick is certainly an example of what I would consider to be a freedom fighter and somebody who has the courage to speak up. I wanted to say that in terms of the Dred Scott opinion, there are very few law professors who include enough of the Dred Scott opinion in their courses so that when I teach my course on civil rights and human rights and students read the Tawney opinion, they're literally blown away because the language is so blunt, and it's a sharp instrument that, you know, justifies the institution of slavery. But what Tawney avoided doing was really giving an accurate view of history to include abolitionists, to include that there was another movement underway that was rejecting slavery. When you read the Dred Scott opinion, it makes it seem like everyone believes in the dominant ideology. Right. And, of course, the other piece of that is that the 13th Amendment overruled the Dred Scott Supreme Court opinion, a constitutional amendment that did more than just eliminate slavery, but granted the rights associated with freedom. And if we can go back to that 13th Amendment, there is so much potential there for dealing with today's badges of racism and of slavery. Right.
Professor Colbert, Doug, always a pleasure to hear from you, man. Thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
You too, sir. Doc, this could be a catalyst for us to not only educate our children about the history of our city, but to fortify ourselves in this battle, re-up, if you will.
That's right.
And get reacclimated to the work that has been done on our behalf for so many decades.
There's so much still that needs to be done. You know, a lot of folks think, you know, we can go where we want, work where we want, go to school where we want. That things have all been righted, and, you know, there's no color barrier. And I'm saying, folks, you live long enough, you experience enough, you'll find that racism is still alive and well. I must hasten to say, though, we have a significant number of folks of other ethnicities, including starting first and foremost with our white brothers and sisters, that are strongly in support of what we're doing. But it's clear that there is not enough. There's not enough folks fighting for freedom and justice. And folks, just because you live in Rice's Town, Randall's Town, or Columbia Town, that doesn't mean you can't come back here to urban areas such as Baltimore City, because we need your help.
Absolutely.
We need your help.
Amen. Doc Cheatham is the CEO of the Matthew A. Henson Community Development Corporation, former president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. Doc, it's always a pleasure to see you, man. Thank you so much.
It is an honor. Honor, as usual.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, NWA Sports Report. We'll be talking about Colin Kaepernick, among other things, with all the usual suspects. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.